ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It is Monday, the 22nd of April. I'm Sally Sara, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, the US House of Representatives approves billions of dollars of assistance to Ukraine. Could it change the momentum of the war? And Game Boy is all grown up. The popular gaming console marks its 35th birthday.
It was no longer this dedicated thing you had to do in a lounge room or sitting at a microcomputer. It was something you could now take out into the world with you, and kind of was a really important step to making gaming kind of more mainstream.
Firstly today, while job sharing is becoming more and more common in Australian workplaces, it's never happened for members of Parliament. Now, Bronwyn Bock and Lucy Bradlow are campaigning to job share the role of the federal member for Higgins in Melbourne's East. But is the proposal workable and legal? Alison Schau reports.
Job sharing is standard practice in Australian offices, but an anomaly in politics. Now there's a push to change that. Lucy Bradlow and Bronwyn Bock are campaigning to be the country's first political job share candidates. Lucy Bradlow says being a politician has become a 24/7 role, and their idea reflects what's happening in the community.
We're seeing a lot more workplaces looking to rearrange roles, reimagine roles, so that they can bring in a whole new crop of talent. And job sharing is one way of doing that.
Bronwyn Bock says she wouldn't be willing to run for a full-time role in Parliament.
Every time I see a politician resign for family reasons, I despair. Not because I don't get it. As a mum of three small children, I do. But because I still want them there representing me. I want Parliament to be representative of the people it represents.
The pair say if elected in the seat of Higgins in Melbourne's East, they'd work 1 week on, 1 week off, and share the same work phone and email.
The good thing about doing this as a job share is we will be able to, as you would in any corporate environment, discuss and debate and work through things together until we came to an agreement on something. And we bring two sets of skills, two sets of experience together to come to a better decision that is in the best interest of the people of Higgins.
So, what do voters think? In Sydney's CBD, the idea is a hit among many.
Oh, I think it's a good idea, actually.
Do you think it's better to have kind of two brains than one?
I think so. That's a great idea. My experience when I was in the workforce of two people job sharing, usually women, they're actually more reliable.
I'm all for women doing as much as they possibly can, and they don't get enough chances these days.
But some think the arrangement should be tested first at the local government level.
If you do job sharing on, let's say, on a state or federal level, and something bad happens and it negatively impacts everyone in the process, it's not going to be a good thing. More or less dependent on the social dynamics between the two people. If things go sour, then that will lead to a lot of issues.
Senate opposition leader Simon Birmingham is also sceptical.
It just doesn't work. The idea that you have representative democracy is to vest that in an individual. That is an age-old proposition. It requires an individual to exercise their judgment, but also to be able to do so consistently.
There are also some big legal hurdles. Anne Toomey is a Professor Emerita in Constitutional Law at the University of Sydney.
It does not sound like something that is in the least bit feasible at the moment. It's neither legally or constitutionally valid would be the main problem. There's nothing in the Constitution or in the legislation that permits more than one person to be elected for an electorate on a job share basis, or even to try and elect two candidates to pretend to be one member of Parliament.
Professor Kim Rubenstein is a constitutional law expert and has been advising the pair.
In my view, they actually lawfully can, and in fact, as a matter of the principles of the Sex Discrimination Act and the Fair Work Act, there'd be an argument to say it's unlawful not to allow them to do it. But it certainly would be helpful if the government amended the Electoral Act to provide more space for them to actually put both their names in.
Professor Rubenstein believes it's also a good idea for democracy.
I think this is one serious and important way of enabling people to think more creatively about power. One of the benefits, I think, of job sharing is that it reminds people that they are the member for an electorate. It's not about the individual. It's actually about the role.
Lucy Bradlow and Bronwyn Bock say if needed, they'd be ready to take their campaign to the High Court.
That's Alison Shaw reporting. Doctors say taxes in some states could threaten efforts to bulk bill more patients. The federal government has tripled the bulk billing payment to GPs to make it easier for patients to access free care. But the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners says that help could be eroded with new state-based rules where practices are now expected to pay payroll tax. They're warning their margins are already too thin and patients will suffer. Stephanie Smale reports.
It was a $3.5 billion boost designed to save bulk billing in a cost of living crisis. But there are concerns the federal government's investment is being eaten away by state taxes. Dr. Nicole Higgins is president of the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners.
So what the federal government was, you know, has been giving with one hand, the states are taking away from another. And the problem with that is we aren't able to bulk bill and pass on charges and or pass on the tax. So that unfortunately means that, you know, practices can't absorb it anymore and those costs will be passed on to the patients that the state are imposing on Medicare.
Under new state payroll tax laws, GPs in all states and territories, except Western Australia, Tasmania and the Northern Territory, will be counted as employees rather than contractors. There's different rollouts in different parts of the country, with a delayed introduction in some states, strategies for doctors to avoid paying the tax, and ongoing consultation about the plan in others. Dr. Higgins says Queensland is making it more manageable, but it's likely to increase the tax take from some medical practices, which is a blow.
There's a lot of anger, there's a lot of confusion. The problem is that it is also retrospectively applied, depending on where you are, up to 5 years, that no one budgeted for, expected, and general practice runs on very thin margins.
In a statement, the Federal Health Minister, Mark Butler, says payroll tax is a matter for states, but he says he's worried historic investments into Medicare will be lost due to the payroll tax rules. He's urged state treasurers, premiers and health ministers to cooperate with GPs on the issue. Australian Medical Association Vice President Danielle McMullen is warning recruiting new GPs is already hard without more financial issues to ward them off.
We already know that we've got work to do to make general practice a more attractive career, and issues like this where there's uncertainty in the tax environment and these challenges that mean increased cost to patients are another chink in the armour of general practice and really work against making it an attractive, rewarding career.
Jane Hall is a distinguished professor in health economics at the University of Technology, Sydney. She says information about the business models of GP clinics and how big or small their margins are isn't available outside the clinic and the tax office. But she explains it is clear that GPs these days are very different to when the funding models were first created.
The model that we have is very much a model based on sort of 30, 40, 50 years ago of the independent practitioner working, and I'm going to say this because that's how it was then, often with his wife as a supporter, as helping run the business. We don't see that now.
As the debate continues over how to fund Australia's growing medical needs, she says it's another complication.
But I think we need to go back to the idea of what primary care provision is, and does it rely on just one medical practitioner providing a service? How could we develop models of care? And there have been some attempts to do that. You know, we've got the urgent care clinics at the moment, but are there ways to do that that recognise you can have different sorts of models?
That's Professor Jane Hall there from the University of Technology in Sydney, ending that report from Stephanie Smale. This is The World Today. The US House of Representatives has approved $147 billion in foreign military aid, including $94 billion to Ukraine. Speaker Mike Johnson stood his ground and eventually gathered enough Republicans to ensure bipartisan support. The Speaker says he hopes history will judge the decision well. Luke Coffey is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C.
absolutely important. Of course, as the Speaker of the House, he is given access to levels of intelligence that your average members are not. He heard from the intelligence communities what Iran, China, and Russia are doing and what they're doing in coordination. If you hear what Speaker Johnson has been saying over the past week or so, he keeps going back to this phrase of these three countries cooperating and coordinating.
What sort of a difference will this aid make to the Ukrainians, do you think?
It'll be life-saving, literally. I was in Ukraine just last month, and not only are they running out of artillery shells and the interceptors that are used to shoot down Russian missiles, but that soldiers on the front lines are starting to ration ammunition for their rifles. So the situation is getting quite desperate. Now, of course, there will be some lag time between the Senate, which will vote in the coming days on this bill, and then when munitions will actually be delivered. But I suspect that the United States has already pre-positioned some of these newer munitions and ammunition in Poland. So as soon as the Senate gives the green light, they will be moved into Ukraine.
We have seen some of those reports, Luke, saying that once this goes back to the Senate and it gets approval from the president, which it will, that they should be able to get particularly some of the ammunition moving quite quickly.
Right now, we need to give the Ukrainians the weapons to strike deep into Russian-occupied regions of Crimea, for example. The big battle we've been facing here in Washington has been on Capitol Hill, but the next battle, and in my opinion, even more difficult battle, will be with the Oval Office trying to convince the president to give Ukraine the long-range weapons that it needs to win, and not just the weapons that Ukraine needs to survive.
Has the world almost been looking the other way over the past couple of months? Has more focus been on the Middle East rather than what's been happening in Ukraine, do you think?
Of course, the world has been focused on what's going on in the Middle East, but we have to do a better job seeing these things as being interconnected. Russia sees Iran's involvement against Israel and Russia's involvement in Ukraine as being connected because Iran is providing key weapons to Russia that Russia's then using against Ukraine, that then Iran learns what works and what doesn't work with its weapons that it's providing to Russia, and then they tweak and modify those weapons so then they can use them better against Israel. That's just one example of how all of this is connected. And we have to start seeing these different conflicts as being connected as well.
Once this aid package starts arriving in Ukraine, will it be enough to make a difference in the conflict against Russia? Will it be enough for Ukraine to start pushing through?
Certainly the funding, the amount of funding and the amount of aid can make a difference so that sometime in 2025, they can launch their next big counteroffensive. The history of warfare is littered with examples of ups and downs by militaries. So just because Ukraine had a not so good year on the land last year doesn't mean that their efforts in the war are doomed. Quite the contrary, with the right policy, the White House can help give Ukraine the weapons it needs to win.
That's Luke Coffey there, Senior Fellow at the Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C. The World Anti-Doping Agency is under pressure for allowing 23 Chinese swimmers who tested positive for a banned substance to compete at the Tokyo Olympics. Several of the swimmers won medals in Tokyo, including three gold. The head of the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency has slammed WADA for accepting China's version of events. Rachel Mealy reports.
It'll be another goal to China. Too good here in the women's 4x2 freestyle relay. And China strike gold. Great Britain will claim the silver medal. Australia will claim the bronze medal. Well done, China.
The swimming world was awestruck by the women's 4x200-metre relay team in Tokyo.
Second gold medal of the night for China. Big time victory there.
But that big time victory may have belonged to Great Britain. China's Zhang Yufei was one of 23 swimmers to have tested positive to the performance-enhancing drug TMZ earlier that year. The bombshell revelation has only just come to light. Travis Tygart is the chief executive of the US Anti-Doping Agency. He says the proper procedure would have seen all of those swimmers suspended from competition.
In our world, the rules are crystal clear. It's strict liability. So if you have a positive test, even if you determine it was some sort of contamination, you have to announce the test, you have to provisionally suspend the athlete, you have to disqualify the results if it's from a competition like it was here. And that wasn't done.
China's anti-doping agency says the positive results had been inadvertent. It says swimmers tested positive for extremely low concentration of TMZ after being exposed to the substance through contamination in a hotel kitchen and should not be held responsible. It says the World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA, agreed with it. But Travis Tygart says WADA has questions to answer.
Even if they believed it was contamination, which, you know, I think it's really difficult to find that this was contamination because these samples also were consistent with the tail end of a, you know, mass administration to prepare for competition. But at the end of the day, it's terrible for the anti-doping system. And all WADA had to do when, you know, they were handed that report in June is do what the rules require, which is to announce the positives. If they wanted to find it was contamination, then okay, fine that it's contamination, but you still have to announce that. You still have to disqualify the results. And don't sweep it under the carpet.
Swimming Australia says it's making inquiries with the sport's global governing body, World Aquatics. Swimming Australia's chief executive, Rob Woodhouse, has released a statement.
As an organisation, we will always advocate for fairness and integrity, and we believe that all athletes deserve the right to earn success by their own hard work, effort and dedication. Clean sport is about respect for your competitors. It's about respect for yourself. It's about respect for sport.
Dr. Steve Georgiakis is from the University of Sydney.
There's clearly a lack of transparency here. I take heart medicine and I take it through tablets. So they need to tell us how a tablet can end up contaminating a kitchen and how not one or two athletes, but 23 athletes became contaminated by this prohibited substance.
He says the scandal could impact the Paris Olympics, which begin in July.
Look, we're less than 100 days out. We've got the prospect of 23 athletes, some of them winning medals at the Tokyo Olympic Games, being stripped of medals. I mean, that has massive legal implications, social implications, and financial implications for the Paris Olympic Games, and in particular for the Olympic movement. The real concern there is that there's a belief that most of the nations and most of the athletes are doing the right thing, but there are rogue figures out there who tried to undermine the integrity of the sport. And the real concern is that there needs to be more transparency with WADA. They police this particular issue.
That's Dr. Steve Georgiakis from the University of Sydney, ending that report from Rachel Mealy. A top executive at Star Entertainment says the casino group is on a journey to change its culture, where until now the customer has always been right. Star is facing a fresh inquiry into its suitability to hold a casino license in Sydney after an earlier probe found the company wasn't moving quickly enough to resolve ethical and legal concerns. The ABC's senior business correspondent Peter Ryan is covering the Star inquiry. I spoke to him a short time ago. Peter, Star is under increasing pressure to hold its Sydney licence. What concessions have we heard today?
Well, Sally, we've been hearing from Scott Saunders, who was appointed Chief Risk Officer at Star in February last year, and he knows the business, you'd imagine, having come from Westpac, where he was the head of financial crime, and earlier, the National Australia Bank, where he was head of anti-money laundering. Mr. Saunders joined Star at a time of crisis after the first inquiry concluded concluded the casino group had set up an inherently deceptive and unethical process to get its house in order. And last week we heard that Star's chairman allegedly spied on the diary of a special external manager, Nicola Weeks, who'd been appointed to independently run the casino. And this was to allegedly determine when Mr. Weeks was in a meeting with New South Wales gaming regulators. Now, under questioning from counsel assisting Casper Condy, Scott Saunders conceded there was a lack of precision in Star's procedures, that the company needed to pay more attention to customers with gambling addictions rather than letting them play. But he said that Star's culture was in the process of changing.
It stems from the Star seeing itself as an entertainment company, one where the customer's always right and we just do what the customer wants. And we are in the process of changing that culture. What that means is sometimes the customer isn't always right. Sometimes they're trying to use our systems to run their nefarious purposes. So there's a journey we're on to move from entertainment company and how we see ourselves to responsible for more than just making the customer happy.
That's Scott Saunders there, the Chief Risk Officer at Star Entertainment Group. And Peter Ryan, it's a critical week for Star during these hearings. Who else is on the witness list?
Well, Sally, in the hot seat this week, we'll be hearing from Star's Executive Chairman David Foster and the former Chief Executive Robbie Cook. Also, Star's Chief Transformation Officer Nicola Burke and Board Director Anne Ward. And some big questions about Star's adherence to anti-money laundering and counter-terror financing laws and what the casino did or allegedly didn't do to protect problem gamblers from themselves.
That's our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. Finally today, Game Boy is all grown up. The portable games console is celebrating its 35th birthday. It brought popular games from the living room to the pocket and sold more than 120 million units worldwide. Angus Randall reports.
Whether you were controlling a plumber, trying to catch them all, or moving a gorilla through the jungle, for a certain generation, their first gaming experience came from a chunky piece of grey plastic.
You know, when you bought a Game Boy, every single pixel could be anything. So, like, there was a whole world beyond the edges of the screen you could go explore. And I remember that being the most amazing thing about the Game Boy.
Japanese games company Nintendo released the Game Boy 35 years ago.
Introducing Game Boy. It's portable, it's in stereo, and its games are interchangeable.
Dr. Brendan Keogh is a video game researcher at the Queensland University of Technology. He says the Game Boy made gaming accessible to all.
It was no longer this dedicated thing you had to do in a lounge room or sitting at a microcomputer. It was something you could now take out into the world with you, and kind of was a really important step to making gaming kind of more mainstream and less this kind of weird secret subculture that nerdy boys did in basements or whatever.
It wasn't the only handheld console on the market. The competitors often had better graphics and a colour screen, but the Game Boy had one huge advantage. It didn't chew through batteries.
So the idea of a Game Boy was the technology behind it was already mature or old by the time it came out. There was nothing technologically exciting about the Game Boy. But because its technology was so old-fashioned, it was using the same kind of screen as pocket calculators, which were already very popular at the time. It was very, very cheap for Nintendo to make. So every Game Boy they sold, they were making a profit.
Nintendo was able to take its in-house arcade stars like Mario, Donkey Kong and Link and transfer them to a portable console. But they also got a huge boost from a game that had been around for half a decade. Tetris sold 35 million units on the Game Boy alone. Dr. Brendan Keogh says the Block Destroyer was perfect for bite-sized gaming.
Very similar to what we see today with mobile phone games, where you have this tiny little puzzle game. You can play it for maybe 5, 10, 15 minutes for one round and then take a break. So it's kind of a perfect game to take with you for like a commute into work or the school bus or playing at lunch at school if the teachers don't see you.
Despite gamers now having hundreds of games in their pocket, there's still a market for 35-year-old technology. Duncan Butcher is from Super Retro in Queensland, which buys and sells old gaming gear.
I think there's something about the design philosophy of the games. I think it's just enduring. You can put the cartridge in, turn it on, and it just plays. You don't get that anymore. Like games, you have to update it for 30 minutes before it starts or things like that. You don't you don't get that kind of just put it in play. And the games themselves, they're just fun. They're simple, but they're fun because they're simple.
If you happen to find your old Game Boy games in the back of a cupboard, don't throw them away. Even well-loved games can still sell for over $100.
Like anything made by Nintendo is a bit like Disney, especially anything published by Nintendo, so stuff like Mario. Very little of it has kind of lost value since it released.
A pair of Pokemon games, still in the box, sold for more than $200,000 4 years ago.
Angus Randall, and that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Sally Sara.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. As Donald Trump works to get back to the White House, abortion's become one of his most problematic issues, with some voters turned off by his pro-life stance. So he's changing his language. It's not what anti-abortion activists wanted, but could it win over some key voters? Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.